I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. So this week we are speaking with Stephen de Millemer, an expert in currency design and blockchain technology. Stephen is on a mission to design and build monetary, economic, and financial networks that put people and planet over profit through the use of complementary currencies. Complementary currencies are designed to fill monetary needs that aren't met by fiat currencies like the dollar.
Our current monetary system just doesn't work for most people, incentivizing growth, depleting our planet's resources, and concentrating a gross majority of wealth in the hands of a select few. Complementary currencies are one way of circumventing that system and introducing new ways to exchange that support community resilience and keep wealth local and decentralized. We're super excited about Stephen's work. Let's have him introduce himself.
My name is Stephen de Millemer, and I'm based in Bali in Indonesia. I'm originally Canadian, but I've been living here in Indonesia for the past 20 years. I'm co-founder of Coin, which is an agency which designs complementary currencies for a wide variety of purposes. I'm also a spokesperson, a representative at the IDK Foundation, which is an Indonesian rupee cryptocurrency stablecoin. So this is a new kind of digital currency that's pegged to the Indonesian rupiah, which we are using for financial inclusion here in this country. I'm also a consultant and trainer and advisor and mentor and very involved in the application of complementary currencies and blockchain technologies for social impact, mostly in the third world. So that would be Latin America, Africa, Asia, and work on hackathons and with a wide variety of teams in this area. So you could say that social impact is where my heart is, and that's probably why I've been living here in Southeast Asia for so long.
So what does it mean? I think our listeners might be interested to hear when you talk about social impact. What are you exactly talking about? And how do these technologies, currencies, engage in that? I mean, what is the real meaning of all of this?
Sure. Well, social impact kind of refers to economic and environmental impact as well, too. So we use social impact just to make it easy for people to understand that we're using money in a way that can change people's lives. What a lot of people don't understand is that money is a human construct that was created by us. It's been enshrined in these large institutions that seem backed by law, by guns, by powerful governments, and they are no longer able to be changed. And while that may be true for the US dollar or the Indonesian rupiah or national currencies around the world, there are thousands and thousands of other ones that are much more human designed that are intended to achieve these specific purposes, whether that's financial inclusion or whether it's improving the environment of a particular area, or incentivizing behavior changes among people in order to encourage them to be better at recycling or composting or whatever the goal is, or to use public transport. There's a wide variety of different outcomes that these kinds of currencies can be used to achieve or designed to achieve. For example, a number of communities in America have started to issue their own local currencies for COVID relief. So this would be currencies that would incentivize people to start spending at local businesses again.
What a great idea. Could you give us an example?
There's a town in Colorado that's it's actually a very simple one. It's more of a token, like a coupon that's denominated in the form of money that you can spend at a local business, and then the local business can pay that as a portion of the taxes that they pay to the town. So that means that any business in the town can accept that local currency, and hopefully that local currency circulates several times before it goes back into the coffers of the local town. And we call that a multiplier effect. It's a standard term in monetary theory that we want to increase the velocity of money. So when you just, the problem with quantitative easing, for example, is that you just issue a ton of money, throw it into the economy and hope that it does something. But it doesn't necessarily do anything. Some people received way more than they needed, and other people didn't receive enough. So the people that received more than they needed are probably investing in gold and the stock market and something that they trust more on a long-term basis rather than actually spending it at local businesses. So it might not have the desired kind of impact. Whereas if you design a currency to circulate rather than to be hoarded, then you can improve the local economy by, you know, because a lot of businesses have been impacted significantly by the downturn that happened because we've all been, shelter in place, or we've had to stay in our homes, or, you know, not go around that much. So we need currencies that circulate more than can be hoarded or saved for the long term. And I think that's something that a lot of governments, larger governments, are missing, because they just don't have access to these kinds of tools that towns and cities can have, or even states, in fact.
When you talk about people, the circulation, right, how does it happen that a dollar being spent doesn't circulate as fast as a token designed for a small business? What is the science behind that?
There's a few things. It's not rocket science exactly, which is great. Dollars just can be spent anywhere, or euros or yen can circulate wherever they want to, because they're accepted throughout the country or even throughout the world. So there's no incentive for that money to stay local and to keep circulating between you two and me and our local business owners or local organizations. And so if there's, you know, if the economy is doing well, that doesn't seem to be an issue. But when the economy slows down a lot, then some kinds of businesses are hit really hard. And so we need, this is when currencies like community currencies start to be designed or come back again, is whenever the economy is going down, because there's a counter-cyclical effect that happens. Local currencies speed up economic activity when the national currency or fiat money, as it's sometimes called, starts to dry up. So we see this people returning to barter and trading more with each other and paying attention to each other's businesses. You know, we're making sure that we're supporting our neighbor's business rather than going to a chain store or something like that. So it's really basically that's all there is to it.
You mentioned economic inclusion, and I think this is one of the biggest topics of the day, especially in the United States, where the rich-poor gap is so wide that a lot of our communities are just completely excluded. And when you combine that with other issues like racial inequality, you have very heavily marginalized communities that where poverty continues for generations. And so this issue of economic inclusion is very critical in this time. How would a complementary currency or any of the tools that you work with achieve a better result for us?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that needs to be understood is that when we talk about banking the unbanked, for example, or financial inclusion, bringing everyone in, it's not the responsibility of banks to go out there and get every customer in the society. There's no incentive really for them to do that. So it's very easy for banks to say, okay, well, we've got the customers we want. They make a certain amount of money per year. They spend a certain amount in the economy. They borrow, they borrow money from us and repay the interest on it as well too, which is great. We want those kinds of people. But there's these other kind of people that we just don't want at all. They don't make enough money. They don't borrow. They can't afford to take out loans, or when they do, they can't repay them. And we don't care about whatever situation they're in that causes that, causes things to be like that. We just care that, you know, we just want to focus on the customers that we want. So financial inclusion is a way of changing the focus of the provision of financial services to these people, people who live in these areas or who have been for one reason or another put into this kind of situation. Now, the great thing about this is we have the technologies at an individual level or a peer-to-peer level to be able to deliver them. We call them financial technologies or peer-to-peer technologies, where we remove the bank as the intermediary in this, and some providers of these financial services do act as kind of an extension of what a bank would normally provide. So they find ways of providing financial services to people who have been economically marginalized. But we're going even further than that more and more now with the introduction of cryptocurrencies and blockchain technologies such as Bitcoin or and others, which are allowing, they provide us with technologies that allow us to issue currencies that can't be broken or taken away or censored or anything. And I think more and more we will be seeing the development of financial services that don't involve banks at all. We're already seeing the rise of peer-to-peer lending. Of course, that's been around a long time with companies like Kiva and so on, but we're seeing an even greater decentralization of lending and with a much broader range of metrics being used to determine if someone is creditworthy, as right down to the social impact and support level, as well as decentralized insurance provision so that people can actually buy insurance, whereas normally they would just not be able to access that through the regular market or through the regular banking system.
Okay, let's take an example here. For example, I am a single mom with three kids living in subsidized housing. How could a complementary currency help my life?
So what it would do is it would make it easier for this this person to connect with other people nearby her who may have what she needs, and in turn she might have what they need or what other people need, so that people are mobilizing the resources that they have and talents that they have to be assisting each other a whole lot more than they are. When we just receive handouts, it keeps us separated from each other and individualized. So it's not easy for people to see the situation that other people are in unless we're able to engage with them in a kind of local economic way, like a cup of flour, with the neighbor, kind of thing, or borrow a cup of sugar, or maybe even more than that. It could be helping someone with childcare, or with improving their home, or renewing their garden, or something like that. Right, things that would improve society all around.
I want to bring it down to someone can actually imagine having this work in their everyday lives. What does that look like?
Right. It's similar. It would be something similar to Neighbourly, if you're familiar with that app. You would be able to create your own profile. Mm-hmm. You'd be able to create your own profile where you would put your address or your location, possibly. You could restrict access to other, your information to keep it private. But if you're agreeing that someone can come over to help you, or if you're connecting with someone in some way, you could be able to share your map location with them so that they could come over, or they could know how far away you are from their place. There would be a wallet function so that you could receive payments from other people or other institutions locally. So you could receive possibly a kind of reward if you've identified infrastructure damage in the community, things that need to be repaired, or a pothole in the road, or you've joined in on a clean neighborhood cleanup, so you'll receive some tokens that you can then use to take the kids skating or to the public swimming pool, something like that. And we've worked with a number of different municipalities worldwide that want to improve the usage of their public infrastructure like that. Public skating, the pools, and so on, public transit. And so you would, all those kinds of things would be built into the app. And then there would be kind of a marketplace where you could offer, like post what you're offering, the kinds of services or skills, but you could also see the kinds of things that the help that people kind of need. So it might be a little bit like Craigslist without the scary bits. It would be generally a bunch more, a lot more about people helping people and getting together to, create a childcare pool or a urban gardening, take over a lot and turn it into an urban garden or something like that would be more the application of it.
I'm wondering if you have kind of a grand vision. You've been working in this area for so long and you're a pioneer, been talking about this, these ideas way before most people have ever even heard of them. And I'm wondering, you stuck with it all this time. What is the vision that you have? What drives you?
Well, I don't have a political agenda per se. I think that everyone should try and be nice to each other and help each other out, rather than be competitive and fighting. And I think that those kinds of values that motivate me. I think that we're coming to another era in the governance of human society, where we're able to take more responsibility for our own affairs. At least that's what my hope would be through the creation of new forms of money. And now that the invention of Bitcoin has been let out of the box, it just seems to me that if that takes hold, if that grows bigger than it already is, because it's 10 years old and it's still quite a tiny quite a tiny currency in world terms, certainly anyway, that, you know, when we change the way that money is designed and issued, we change the forms of government that are around them. It's part of the natural process of decentralization, you know, in many things, not just governance, but it's also the role that digital technologies are playing in our lives. So when we can take an idea, especially a human idea, and quantify it digitally, then it's much easier for us to start making all sorts of new things out of it. And we see that with media and music and all sorts of other things that we've been able to, you know, to take and start to create whole new forms of wealth out of.
Would it require mayoral approval to have a complementary currency in a marginalized community in New York or anywhere else?
No, it doesn't. And from what I'm understanding now as well, too, that laws have recently changed in America that would even allow counties and possibly even states to issue their own currencies. And we've seen in many other places as well, too, worldwide, where governments might say, well, we don't really like this. This could impact our currency in ways that we haven't been able to accommodate. But that's usually just because they don't like competition. You know, they would prefer to keep money as a monopoly and not have to prove the strength and the solidness of their currency relative to a competitor, which is why it's important to have competition between currencies as well. Mm-hmm. It's funny, we just think that, well, there should only be one kind of currency, the currency of our country, the US dollar, the Canadian dollar, or the Indonesian rupiah, that can only circulate within the bounds of our country. But in fact, we're getting to a point where with air miles and bonus, you know, all sorts of loyalty rewards that are becoming more and more and more like money, that we're already in a multi-currency economy. There are many, many communities in America that have their own currencies. Legally, sometimes with the support of the municipality and the mayor and council and so on, and sometimes not, you know, their citizen initiatives or through community organizations that issue these currencies or launch these systems in order to achieve a particular kind of outcome. And all ranges of that are legal, you know. So we see the for example, with cryptocurrencies, with BitLicense in New York, on the one hand, and then you have the ability to pay your taxes in Wyoming and Arizona with Bitcoin. So you have a very wide range of regulatory options to choose from, even just within America.
Does Bitcoin have the capacity to continue to thrive? Like, isn't it a limited currency?
Well, each Bitcoin can be divided into 100 million pieces. So although there's only 21 million Bitcoins that will ever be issued into the Bitcoin system or the Bitcoin economy, that you can go 21 million times 100 million, and then you get an idea of just how large actually the monetary base could actually be if the value of Bitcoin continues to rise. Although I'm not suggesting it become a replacement for national currency, because I think that, again, I agree with competition between currencies. So I think that there's many ways that, you know, many different currencies that need to be issued, and Bitcoin is certainly not the only way to be doing it. But it points the way to how we can issue money into an economy that can't be played around with by governments and leaders or councils or Federal Reserves and so on. But it has a purely algorithmic issuance. You know, a certain amount is issued every 10 minutes into the economy, and there's no human in the world, no collection of humans in the world, no power at all in the world that can change that simple fact. and that's really amazing, right? But then it's only issued to people who are securing the network. So it's not a currency that's accessible to everyone. So it's exclusive in a certain way. And it's only purchasable with fiat money or with national currency. So it's not a currency that is designed for financial inclusion. It helps in a lot of ways. You know, it's radically transparent. You know, all the transactions are visible. So there are things about it that point towards an interesting future about how money could look. But it's not the most ideal form of money out there either at the same time. But it being valuable, being having its positive sides and having its negative sides means that there will be other currencies that will have other positives and other negatives to them, and so on. So I think that does go back to what you were talking about regarding balance between currencies earlier, that we can see a future where, or give a place, see a place where these kinds of currencies are going to fill into the yin gap that's been left kind of exposed for a long period of time, or has only flourished within certain kind of communities. You could say more libertarian oriented if you're kind of right wing, or more hippie oriented if you're kind of left wing. And it's sort of where the two of those kinds of people actually get together and in one room and can understand each other's language a little bit more. Which is funny in a way, because I've seen that happen.
I wonder if we could speak a little bit to how complementary currencies could be employed to address climate change, which is another one of the big topics that we face in the near future.
Yes, absolutely. But it's an area where we haven't seen a whole lot of innovation just yet. So we're trying to figure out. I think people in this field are trying to figure out what the best direction is. We can see a change to how carbon credits are being issued. That's one really big area. So carbon credits are still a very carbon credits circulate in a very tiny market, or very enclosed or exclusive market, and it's not one where citizens can normally be involved in. You know, it's not easy for, say, you or me to go and buy some carbon credits and start investing in them with the expectation that we might be, you know, incentivized or receive some stability at least in our investment regarding them. So they're not really an investment mechanism that encourages people to buy them. There are other ways where we can encourage people to make use of lower carbon transportation options, you know, by encouraging people to walk or bicycle or take public transit instead of driving their own personal car. So that's one way, another way in which these kinds of currencies could be issued or designed, have the incentives designed around them. But we've really only seen a few of those kinds of approaches being taken, because it's still really hard for people to determine what kind of approaches to take, and perhaps because there are sort of bigger problems on the nearer future, especially as a result of this pandemic, that people are concerned about tackling rather than, you know, I mean, as we've kind of seen, issues of climate change have kind of gone on the back burner as a result of this current situation. And once this is over, and I'm very sure it's going to be over, then issues of climate change and the Arctic and the Antarctic heating up and melting more rapidly than we expected are going to be coming back on the front burner again and saying, okay, well, we've seen the awesome things that have happened in our lives as a result of this pandemic happening. I mean, there's been many fantastic things that have happened in my own life as a result of slowing down and not traveling so much and engaging more closely with my family, community, friends, and colleagues. So there, I think a lot of people have really appreciated that. There are a lot of people who can really see the good side of what's happened here. And that slowing down is possible, and a less consumptive lifestyle is definitely possible to achieve. So with that in mind, we might be able to see a bit of a marriage between the two situations, where people continue to reduce their salaries by 20% or take a day off each week, go to a 4-day work week so that other people can be employed, and those kinds of changes. And maybe complementary currencies can come in there as well to assist or give the nudge where needed.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Awesome. You can learn more about Stephen's work at network-economies.com, coinacademy.co, coin.org, where coin is spelled with a Q, and complementarycurrency.org, where you can explore starting a complementary currency of your very own. We'll include all of these links with our show notes at the bottom of our website, podofgold.world.
If you like this conversation, you should also check out some of our previous conversations about currency design, such as with Ben and Inez, Kate Raworth, Anand John, Jean-Aubert de Limon, and Gwen Holsmith. So we directly link those episodes in our show notes. You simply need to go there and click.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at podofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.